Everyone who has gone to school has something to say about teachers, about schools, and about education in general. But is popular opinion, fueled often by myth and anecdote, as valid as the considered judgment of educators and researchers? To help us make sense of the education debate, we're joined by educational leader Dr. Irvin Scott. That's this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University, alongside my friend and colleague, G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. Each week, we take a look at the narratives and stories shaping American public life. This week, our guest is Dr. Irvin Scott. In 2011, he became the Deputy Director for K-12 Education at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Now he's a senior lecturer at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education. Irvin, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
So let's start with a really broad question. What role do schools, K-12 schools, play in American society today, and what role should they play?
So they play an absolutely essential role, critical role. I think it's one of the reasons why the founders of this country actually made education a part of the Constitution, made it compulsory, because a democratic society can't thrive without an educated citizenry. So absolutely essential, absolutely critical. Then and now, and probably has become even more critical given some of the disparities that have grown over time in our country, where those who have can afford oftentimes the greatest education, and those who have not always aren't afforded the most high quality educational experience.
Now, education is a frequent topic of debate politically. Mm. President Trump has named and the Senate confirmed Betsy DeVos to be the Secretary of Education. Mm-hmm. She gave what I would call sort of a remarkable speech at the Conservative Political Action Committee's annual conference last week, and I kind of want to get your sort of take on a couple of things that she said. She painted kind of a dystopian picture of American education in general, schools in particular, and then she pointed a finger, and I'm going to quote her. She said, quote, "The education establishment has been blocking the doorway to reforms, fixes, and improvements for a generation." Where do you come down on the role of the school establishment, such as it is, in the process of reform?
So it's hard to answer the question without completely understanding what she means by school establishment. I think many people would interpret that in different ways, depending upon where you fall down on the education reform debate. Some might characterize that as unions. Someone might characterize that as the administration that oversees schools. I'm not sure what she actually meant. I will say that there remain areas of development and growth in education, because there remain a group of students who disproportionately perform worse than others. Mm-hmm. And so as long as that disparity exists, we as educators, but not just educators, all of us who value education for American children should look for ways to improve it. So in some ways I would say, yeah, there are ways that we can improve, there are ways that we can reform the system so that there is more equity of opportunity, more equity of achievement for students. And so there's definitely work to do. I think just politically, leaders come into positions and they have to establish sort of this idea of a burning platform, if you will. And I think if I were in her position, I'd be doing the same thing. I'd be looking for all the ways that we can improve. I'd probably spend a little more time saying what has happened and where there has been success and where there are assets for us to build on. But I get that that's what you do when you come into a leadership position.
She and the president seem to be focusing on school choice as a means of reform. What are your thoughts on that broad concept?
Yeah, so broadly speaking, it's a political hot button issue. And anytime there's a political hot button issue, one of the things that I do just as a as an educator, but also as a father, as a parent, is I try to get as close to the parent perspective, the student perspective as possible, and get as far away from the political aspect as possible. So from a parent standpoint, and I have children, they're not in the K-12 system, they're in higher education right now, but as a parent, I always wanted the best opportunity for my children. And my children are different. Irvin, Leon, and Nicholas are very different from one another. And there were times when they had different needs based on their developmental stage, based on their interest. And what I understand as a parent, if there are educational opportunities or educational systems that can cater to their needs better than others, then I want to go after that educational system. So choice to me from a parent perspective is a good thing because I have different children who have different needs, who have different desires, and to the extent that I can have options for them, that is a good thing. As a middle class, upper class individual in our society, if I were in that position or those who are in that position, the more means you have, typically the more choice you have, right?
Right.
You can send your kid to private school, you can send them to a parochial school, you can send them to a public school. What often happens in our society is the less means you have, the less choice you have. Is that fair? I'm not sure if that's fair. I'm not sure if a democratic society should be one where the less means you have, the less choice you have, especially with something as critical as education. So my general sense in answering your question is that choice is a good thing, no matter who you are. And of course, the devil's in the details.
So I mean, I'm hearing a sort of a social justice case for school choice there.
Yeah.
Is that accurate?
I think in some ways it is a matter of justice. It's a matter of social justice. It's a matter of equity of opportunity. It's a matter of ensuring that what we want for those who have the most in our society should be the same for what we want for those who are struggling in our society. That's what John Dewey, one of the founders of public education in this country, or philosophical founders of public education in this country, suggested should be the case. And I tend to believe that personally.
Yeah. I mean, I think most people, most reasonable people would agree with that. But then the question becomes, how do you provide that opportunity for all people, regardless of racial status, regardless of where they live in the country or in a state or even within a particular city?
Mm-hmm.
How do we sort of level all of that out? Because the disparities are well-known, well-chronicled, and in some cases, large.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the ways we've decided to do it as a country historically is through additional funding for communities where there are these struggles. And those struggles usually are correlated with economics and race, right? So African-American, Latino students, traditionally, and I should say Native American students usually underperform other demographics in this country. And so what we've done, of course, is we've said we're going to give them additional money through Title I. We're not going to have it be so dependent upon real estate taxes and other things, which is the basic way we fund education in this country. So we're going to do Title I additional funding. People typically don't have a problem with that. I mean, that's a good thing. But what we've done lately is we've said, well, we need also, along with additional funding, sort of new and innovative ways to do education for those communities, such as choice, right? So the emergence of charter schools, the emergence or the discussion around vouchers. These are policy levers that people are saying, this may be a way of also addressing these challenges. In order for us to ensure that students of color, students with lower socioeconomic status, can have the same opportunity. And I think those types of things should be explored. I think there are obviously there are winners and losers. But for me, the big question is kids end up in those.
How do you respond to the criticism? So there have been ballot initiatives in a number of states trying to, in Massachusetts, where you live now.
Yeah.
Back in November, there was a ballot initiative trying to increase public funding for public charter schools.
Yeah.
How do you respond to the pushback that says that every dollar that you spend on a public charter school is going to penalize students who are in traditional public schools?
I would respond by saying we should do everything we can to avoid that, right? But I'm not sure if the answer is to completely squelch the growth of effective charter schools, which give parents more opportunity or more options to place their students in it. So don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, right?
And when you say effective charter schools, how do you measure effectiveness?
Yeah, to me, effectiveness is, again, this is my definition of effectiveness, has everything to do with whether students are growing academically,
yeah.
Whether students are, I would expand that aperture, because we normally think of effectiveness just around math and science and reading. I think those are basics and they have to be a part of effectiveness. I think lately there's been some really healthy discussion around, are there more things besides math, science, and reading that should be important? And so there's been an expansion of focusing on social and emotional learning, grit and perseverance. All of those things are really important. But that's what I tend to talk about when I talk about effectiveness. What would I want for my own children? What would you want for your children? Right. That's what I usually mean.
You've talked about the role of the federal government mm-hmm. in improving the quality of education. U.S. News and World Report just came out with its first ever ranking of best states. And they used a very detailed, intricate methodology. I happened to look at it, and it seems quite credible. So they ranked the 50 states on 7 different broad categories, including education.
Mm-hmm.
Your state now, Massachusetts, ranked number 1 overall. Mm. The 2 outliers truly were the last 2, and those were Louisiana and Mississippi, which ranked on the 7 categories, including education, very poorly. What do we do about that? We're still a union of 50 states, and how do you address the really poor performing parts of the country?
Yeah. So let me first commend the notion that we're still a union of 50 states, because there are many people in this country who don't believe that I should be worried about Mississippi if I live in Massachusetts, or I should be worried about Maryland
right.
if I live there. There are certainly
a lot of people like that.
There are a lot of people, and that's very unfortunate. It's very unfortunate. I often talk about the United States interstate travel system. The reason why we have that I-95 and I-5 and I-40 across the country is because someone very many years ago, Dwight Eisenhower, I think, was the...
It was Dwight Eisenhower.
Yeah,
yes.
Who had the idea that this country can only be great if it acts like a country as opposed to individual states. And so I think the same notion is true for education. And so to answer your question, number one, it should be a worry for Massachusetts. Number two, I would say that in Louisiana, at least in New Orleans, there has been some... I would characterize it as dramatic improvement over the years as a result of some of the innovation that they've been doing, quite frankly, around school choice and giving parents their options. So things are happening. Are they happening at the rate that they should happen? Probably not, if you're one of those family members. But to me, you have to be innovative around the options that you give parents to make thoughtful decisions. You have to be innovative around making sure that the schools that exist are really strong schools. And that to me boils down to great teaching, great content, great curriculum, high standards for kids, great leadership, all the things that you would want in an effective organization in order for that organization to get results are pretty much the same things that have to happen in an effective school. So how do you ensure that those things happen? Or an on an ongoing basis becomes one of the critical questions.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, a weekly look at the stories that shape our understanding of public policy. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University, and I tweet at JM Lutis. Alongside me each week is G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. He tweets at G. Wayne Miller. Story in the Public Square is produced by an amazing team of professionals at Rhode Island PBS in Providence. An audio version of each episode is broadcast four times each weekend on Sirius XM's The POTUS Channel, 124. Our guest this week, tweeting at iScott4, is Irvin Scott, currently at the Graduate School of Education at Harvard. Irvin, I want to ask you a question. So we've talked a little bit about the politics of education, and one of the frequent refrains that you hear is that nobody knows better about education than you, the parent, or nobody knows more about education than people at the local level. And so this might be a little bit of a meta question, but who should we be looking to and trusting for advice about what really constitutes a good education?
So let me make a distinction between education and children. Parents should be and are the expert around their children. I'm not sure parents would say they should be the expert around how to educate their child, especially from K to 12 or K to 16.
Yeah.
So who is the expert? Who should be the leader around individual children growing in a system, or individual children growing? The parent should. And so there's no way to do education for that child from K through 12 without engaging deeply with the parent, without engaging deeply with guardian, without engaging whoever is the closest individual to that child. When it comes to education, however, then there's another group of people who become critical, and I believe those are teachers who do the day-to-day work of engaging with children and teaching them content and facilitating learning opportunities. And the leaders who where that learning happens, and so school principals. So if you were to ask me who should lead, it should be parents, teachers, and school leaders. And everybody else becomes a sounding brass and tinkling cymbal to sort of set up the structures that enable that context to work as beautifully as it possibly can.
Among the things you've done in your distinguished career, you've been a teacher for many years, a frontline actual teacher. I'm one of those people who has great respect for teachers of all kinds because I think they're so critical. Sometimes in the current climate, they kind of get a bum rap. They're blamed for things that they don't cause, and they're blamed for things that they didn't do that they can't change. Mm. Talk to that. I mean, I think the teacher today is being asked to do far more than certainly 50 years ago or 100 years ago because society in many ways has changed.
Yeah. No, I think that is exactly right. As you said, I taught for 15 years, loved it with a passion. High school English teacher taught in a community where there was a pretty big divide between those who have and those who didn't have, and I taught the whole range. And let's just establish something right now really clearly. It is a complex, difficult job to teach children, and more importantly, to teach them at a high level, to teach them content, to teach them the Pythagorean theorem. First of all, you got to understand the Pythagorean theorem. It's one thing to understand it. It's another thing to try to teach it to 30 kids all at one time.
This right? My wife, the math teacher, would explain to you about me. Yeah.
Exactly.
No, this is why I have such respect for teachers. I mean, I could not possibly do it. I wouldn't have the patience, the understanding, the knowledge, or the know-how.
Exactly. So much goes into it. And so to answer your question, yes, they do get a bum rap. At the same time, the country taxpayers make contributions to those individuals to do it at the highest level, right? So you pay taxes, I pay taxes. I pay taxes to ensure that education happens amongst many things in our country at a high level. So do I want them to be better? Do I want them to grow? Do I want them to learn more? Do I want them to advance? Do I want them? Absolutely. And as a taxpayer, we should want the absolute best. Like you would go into Nordstrom and say, I'm going to pay for that product and I want to make sure it's a quality product. I think we should have the same type of expectations around education. Here's one distinction, though. There are people who say, well, the difference between the Nordstrom example and education is that teachers don't control who come into their classroom. Kids come with all types of challenges, with all types of issues and difficulties, and that is very true. And that's one of the reasons why it's so important for education, the education sector, to partner really tightly, I think, with those other sectors, whether it be health and community services, or whether it be housing, whoever is surrounding a family or a group of students to support that family or group of students. Education should be partnering with them, because educators can't do everything. We can't expect a teacher to take on all the responsibilities that's required to move a student. We've got to partner with those who actually help do that.
And how big a factor is when you think about why some schools succeed and others don't? How big a factor are the broader community issues? Whether you're in a crime-laden area, whether you're in a poverty-stricken area, how big a factor are those things that are external to the classroom in the success of students and schools?
Yeah, to say that they are not a factor is to not be truthful. To say that they are factors that should inhibit, that inhibit and should inhibit excellent education for children is also not to be truthful. To act like they don't exist and say, well, you know what, the kid who comes from Chestnut Hill, Massachusetts, should be able to, or the kid who comes from an impoverished neighborhood, should be able to achieve at the same level as a kid from Chestnut Hill, Massachusetts.
Affluent suburb.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah. I actually believe that is true. But to say that you can treat them the same in order for them to achieve is not true. I think you should have the same expectations for them, right? That's fundamentally critical. But I do think you have to do something different for those who come from a more impoverished neighborhood. And one of those things that you have to do differently is engage more intentionally with those who are also supporting that individual in the impoverished neighborhood.
Another story that you hear frequently today, particularly on certain talk radio shows, is that teachers and teachers' unions run the education system, and all they're interested in is feathering their own pockets and work to rule. And how do you respond to that? I mean, you must hear it too.
You've been a teacher, you've been an administrator, you've seen this from both sides.
Yeah, I have. That's a good point, Jim. I've been a teacher, so I've been a part of a union. I've been an administrator where I had to work with the union. I've seen it from, as you said, from both sides. And it's just not that black and white. It's not like all unions are totally against improving teaching or teaching profession. And it's not like unions don't have work to do. Both of those things can be true. There is work for unions to do, I think, to advance the profession of teaching. One of those things that I think is focusing more on how you actually improve teaching, as opposed to just exclusively, and I shouldn't say that just exclusively, like this is all they work on, but most people know them to be focused on bread and butter issues, compensation, salary, fairness, all of that. I think I would argue, how do we expand the aperture around also focusing on how to improve practice? And I think there are unions out there that do exactly that work. I think it just creates more divisions to act like the unions are the problem. I don't think they are the problem. I think they can be a part of the solution, and we have to find ways to sort of tap into what they're really good at and work with them, as opposed to acting like they are part of the problem. The other thing I would say is there are many school districts where they have figured out how to partner in thoughtful, engaging, and productive ways with their unions, and we should be able to learn from them. But to set up camps around unions are the problem, I think just creates more division. Well, it's unhealthy.
I think it's black and white thinking, what you said.
Is exactly
and
right.
Far too often, we people sometimes think black and white when it's not black or white.
And it's easy to do that.
It is. It's exactly.
It's not necessarily healthy.
And related to this, I know that some of the work that you did while you were at Gates was focused on empowering teachers. Mm. What needs to happen so that teachers are afforded the respect and have the position in society that I think probably the three of us around this table might agree about? I think a lot of people are sort of consumed by the myth that Wayne began his last question with.
Yeah, I think there's work to do both on the front end during and let's just call it the front end and while they're in the profession. When I say on the front end, I mean teacher preparation institutions. I think there's a lot of work to do in that space to ensure that teachers come into the profession more prepared to teach from day one. Some of that work is making sure that they have strong content experiences. So if you're going to be an English teacher, you should spend a lot of time really understanding literature, really understanding writing. If you're going to be a math teacher, you should spend a lot of time really understanding conceptually math, not just teaching math, but conceptually understanding why did Pythagoras actually to develop a theorem. I keep going back to that because my wife recently took me through.
It's the one you remember.
I don't know anything about it. I know I was taught it, but I don't know zero.
Exactly. I am an English teacher, and oftentimes as an administrator, I use Pythagorean theorem. Yeah. And so one evening she sat me down and said, let me take you through why Pythagoras came up with this theorem. But anyway, so if you're going to teach
we'll take a call from her anytime, by the way.
If you're going to teach those content areas, you should have deep experience with content, right? So that's on the preparation. You should also have a good, strong practicum. We would never expect a physician to go to do surgery on someone if they didn't spend years actually understanding how to do surgery, looking at a surgeon do it who's really good at it. So teacher preparation is one big area. The other thing is, once they get into profession, just really on a very practical level, teachers need more time to grow their practice with one another. Teaching is too isolated. One of my favorite quotes, I got it from one of my professors, is this quote, and it's true for everything. Isolation is the enemy of improvement. Yes. It's so true. If you want to get better at something, you don't go hide. You go find others who are better at it, and you actually expose your practice to them so that you can grow.
We got to leave it there, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Irvin Scott, I want to thank you for helping us make sense of what is really a complex issue, like so many others. That's all the time we have this week. If you want to learn more about Storing the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or visit pellcenter.org. For Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, inviting you to join us again next week for more Story in the Public Square. Have a great week.